So what have we learned so far? So what we have learned is the following. Say that we have a Hamiltonian that is depends in a smooth way by some parameters, lambda. And this is the sum of local operators. We have learned the following things, that when we study the ground state of this Hamiltonian, the set of all the ground states that are therefore parameterized by lambda splits in different regions. For instance, for the quantumizing model, our parameter is just one parameter, is our parameter G. So this is a one-dimensional object, manifold. And for G smaller than GC, we have a certain situation that we call paramagnetic phase. And or actually it's the other way around, doesn't matter. 1 over G in the Ising model. And then we have the ferromagnetic phase. But what does characterize these different phases? OK, here we have that the ground state is unique. And the ground state has the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And by the way, these two facts are almost identical, because if the ground state didn't have the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian, it means that by acting with that symmetry on the ground state, I obtain another ground state, because the symmetry is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And so the ground state is unique. Then we have a gap above the ground state. And all correlation functions decay exponentially with some correlation length. On the other side, instead, we have that the ground state is not unique, exactly because breaks the symmetry. So if you act with your symmetry operator on one of the two ground states, you go into the other one. This is exactly means, oh, they do not commute with a symmetry operator. They are not invariant under the symmetry. That's why there is more than one. As a consequence, if I make equal superposition, say, of these two maximally symmetry breaking states, in this state, the connected correlation functions do not decay exponentially and are just a function of G. So they do not decay at all. In between, we have a critical point in which the gap goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. And as a consequence, correlation functions decay only algebraically. So they decay, but with a power law. OK, so this is what we have learned. We have also learned a bunch of techniques to argue about all these points. Yes?
Could you remind why is it that we need to consider the connected correlation function?
So the connected correlation functions, first of all, have a meaning. They have a meaning that they tell us what is the correlation between fluctuations at different sites. The non-connected correlation functions do not see correlations between fluctuations. For instance, if you have all spins up, the connected correlation, the non-connected correlation functions are non-decaying, but the connected one would be identically zero because if you have all spins up, the spins are not fluctuating at all. But when you have this state that is the equal superposition of these two, now you have, when you measure spins, in what direction they are, well, they fluctuate, right? Because you have a distribution probability of being up or being down. However, not only they fluctuate, but the correlation between fluctuations at different sites are non-vanishing, and this is given by the correlation, connected correlation function. And in order to have non-vanishing connected correlation functions, which we call long-range order, you need to superimpose the two symmetry maximally symmetry broken states. If you only consider one of them, then it is the non-connected correlation functions that do not decay. And sometimes, depending on the textbooks, also this is called the long-range order. So long-range order can mean either it is two different facts, and so it must be clear that, you know, these two things can be different. And also, one more property, these were meant in the direction z. Sigma z acquires sample to sample a non-vanishing expectation value. There are some states, like the symmetric state, in which this has a zero expectation value. But generically, in the ground state manifold, this has a non-vanishing expectation value. And we refer to spontaneous symmetry breaking, the fact that not only sample to sample, this is different from zero, but that for some mechanism that we have only summoned without really explaining so far, this is what actually happens if you were to do the measurement. In other words, the symmetric states, those that do not break the symmetry, for some reason are not possible. You never see them. These are the Schrödinger cats. We have not argued yet as to why this is not possible. So let's just take it as a fact. Okay. So if this happens, then we say, oh, this is spontaneous symmetry breaking. Every time I make a measurement, I see this different from zero. In absence of this explanation, one can just say, okay, you know, if I just randomly take a state in a ground state manifold, then this is true. Okay? So this is what we have learned so far. And the two phases are marked. So remember our initial discussion. We want to say that two states are in the same phase if they have something important in common, which is not the detail of what is the expectation value of a given operator, but something that we call important or macroscopic. And in this case is that all these states are z in the ground state, are z to symmetric. And all these states break the symmetry. When I say all, I mean almost all, because only these ones do not break the symmetry. Only this particular choice. Okay? But also this particular choice can be detected by the correlation functions, connected correlation functions having long range order. Okay, so this is what we've learned so far. And for a very long time, in theoretical condensed matter physics or in quantum many-body theory, this was pretty much all the picture that we had. So we thought that all the possible phases when you have a many-body system are labeled by different patterns of symmetry breaking. Maybe your parent Hamiltonian has SO3 symmetry. This SO3 symmetry can be broken in different ways, and those would be the phases of that model. Okay? So now we want to make a few remarks as about why we have a need to go beyond this picture. Okay, so and this is a very modern way of thinking, something that has been developed in the past 10, 12, 15 years. So first of all, question. Is this definition non-ambiguous? And the reason why I ask that is the following. Because imagine that to my Ising Hamiltonian, so I have my Ising Hamiltonian, I add the term, this term, H, the sum over sigma z. So I add a longitudinal field. So what effect would have the addition of this field in the z direction to the ground state of the model when we are in the ferromagnetic phase? So remember, without this in the Ising model, the ground state is double degenerate. So this is a ground state, this is a ground state, any superposition of the two is a ground state. But what happens now if I add this term? Sorry, I couldn't hear you very well.
You pick one of the states to be the ground state.
Yes, yes, you gap them away. In particular, if this is greater than zero, if H is greater than zero, then you pick this ground. This is the unique ground state. You get them away. So your ground state becomes suddenly non-degenerate. So now consider this phase diagram, in which here I have G, which is my transverse field. Here I have my critical point. And now this is H. Now imagine that I'm here. I'm in the ferromagnetic phase. I have a double degenerate ground state. Now I switch on this field, H, and I gap these two states away. Okay? And now as I gap these two states away, I increase my transverse field. This is one over G. I increase my transverse field, so I start moving in this direction towards the paramagnetic phase, and then I switch off my longitudinal field. And I land here in the paramagnetic phase. All along this path, the gap never closed, because there is always a gap between states like this because of H. And only at the very last moment, I close that gap. But at that point, I'm deep in the paramagnetic phase. So there is only the states in the x direction that are the ground state. So as you can see, I have said, oh, you know, this is the paramagnetic phase. This is the ferromagnetic phase. So there are different phases. In between, there is a quantum phase transition, a domain of non-analysity of my ground state energy. But now look, continuously, without ever closing the gap, I go from one to the other. So you see, somehow some of the things that have said that we have said don't hold anymore. So if at this point I would say, oh, okay, if these are very different, first of all, how come I can go continuously from one to the other?
Isn't that a feature of classical phase transitions as well? If we operate at non-zero field, we can always circumnavigate the...
That's correct. That's correct. So the same question... Well, so the same question stands. Okay? So also for classical phase transitions, that's entirely correct. How can our definition of phases as domains of analysity of the free energy density or of the ground state energy density hold in the face of this, of the fact that we add some term in the Hamiltonian and then we can circumvent these points? So this is the first remark that I want to make, and I want you to think for a minute and see if with what we know we actually do have an answer for that, and we do. Okay? So somehow, all you need to know to answer this question is on the blackboard. We don't need to learn something else. We recognize there is a problem, but we do have a way to address this problem. What is it?
Is it the symmetry of the Hamiltonian?
Perfect. Very, very well. So let's try to elaborate. It's about the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So what is happening now?
It's not symmetric anymore.
Yes. You see, this term breaks the Z to symmetry. Right? So if I break the Z to symmetry of the Hamiltonian, the concepts of phases as a symmetry broken or not broken phases simply is not there anymore, right? Because I do not have a symmetry of the Hamiltonian that I can possibly break in the ground state, right? Because this explicitly breaks the Z to symmetry. So there is no symmetry breaking that can happen in the ground state because the symmetry is not there at all. So why this solves our problem? Because what we care about is symmetry. This is what is important that we said characterizes the phase. So if we care about symmetry, this means that we can only transform the Hamiltonian with that symmetry, preserving that symmetry. Oh, and then we encounter a quantum phase transition, because we have two different patterns of symmetry breaking. If we do not care about symmetry, so if we declare, it's not symmetry what is labeling my phases, well then, they are the same phase. The only thing that distinguishes a paramagnet from a ferromagnet is the pattern of symmetry breaking. But if I declare, no, this pattern is not my concern, they are in the same phase. They are indistinguishable if you don't choose to use the symmetry breaking as a criterion to distinguish them. But if you say, no, I want to know what are the phases labeled by symmetry, then you are forced to move only around here. Because only here live the Hamiltonians that have the Z2 symmetry. And then I'm forced to encounter a quantum phase transition. Is this clear? There is no such a absolute concept of two things being in the same phase. Being in the same phase means they're in an equivalence class that you define with respect to some properties that you care about. So if you care about symmetry, Well, this means, oh, my parameter space must have, the Hamiltonian must have a symmetry, and then look how this is broken. If you decide, oh, I don't, it's not symmetry what characterizes my macroscopic quantity, then they are in the same phase, because they're only distinguished by symmetry. Okay, so this is the first remark. Second remark. Is the symmetry breaking labeling of quantum phases exhaustive of all the possible macroscopic quantum phases? So imagine that I have some Hamiltonian, depending on some parameters. And I say, oh, okay, I impose some symmetries and all my phases, you know, all my parameter space splits in some way. And these are all different patterns of the symmetries that are residual in the ground state. And this characterizes all the possible ground states of local quantum systems. Meaning, given any two states that are ground states of two local Hamiltonians, if I break the symmetry, then I can actually go from here to here, always. And the only reason why I can't is because they break some symmetry. Or is it instead possible that there are other domains, other states, that even if I break all the possible symmetries of the system, from here I cannot go to here without a phase transition? In other words, if I take all the possible ground states of local Hamiltonians, are they distinguished only by symmetries, or there is something like a quantum phase transition that goes on even if you don't change the symmetry? And in order to see whether it is possible that there is something else, we have to look exactly at this behavior of the correlation functions. The answer, the root for an answer is there. So, as you can see, in this case, where you have a unique ground state, you have exponentially decaying correlation functions. And where you have a degenerate ground state, but these two ground states are distinguished by the symmetry, right? Because this is, they break the symmetry. So the symmetry operator sends one in the other. When I superimpose them, I have a long range order. So the possibility that is left out is that you have a degenerate ground state, but you do not have a long range order. That somehow these two degenerate ground states have the same symmetries. So even if I superimpose them, I will still have fast decaying correlation functions. So this is the only logical possibility that is left open. Although this is weird, right? Because how can I have a degeneracy if there is not some symmetry breaking? What else can give you a degenerate ground state that is not some symmetry? So, a lot of the discussion of next week will be about this, about other kinds of order that go beyond symmetry breaking. So let's believe for a second that maybe there is other kinds of order beyond symmetry breaking. How would we even learn that? Imagine that I give you a Hamiltonian and we want to explore if this has phases beyond symmetry breaking. How do we know that? Because now we cannot just see, you know, different patterns of symmetry, because it's exactly what we don't want to see. So somehow we need another notion of saying two states are in the same equivalence class, which is not symmetry, something more general. So, and this is the topic of this lecture, is in what sense quantum states are similar. They are in the same class. We would give a definition of a distance between quantum states, and we will say that two quantum states are in the same class if this distance is smooth as we move in this class. And then there is a quantum phase transition when this distance has a spike or a divergence. Okay? So what is the distance between two quantum states? I believe some of you know something about this from quantum information courses, right? Or not at all? Or you have never heard about this? Good, okay, so you will learn it here. Okay, so what is the distance between quantum states? I got a very lousy chalk today. I don't know what happened. Okay, what is the distance between quantum states? So quantum states are something complicated, but if you had to say what is the meaning, I know you're taking a course before me of quantum foundations, so what is the meaning of the quantum state? Have you talked about it this so far? So what did they say?
So it's either it represented a probability distribution. Or
very good, very good. I'm happy with this answer. The state, the quantum state, represents a probability distribution. Okay, we will see in 5 minutes how it represents a probability distribution. But for the time being, I want to take this answer as perfectly good and say, okay, so if I want to distinguish two quantum states and say how far apart they are, I should at the very least learn how to distinguish and consider a distance between two probability distributions. Okay, this is what we want to do. And in statistics, if I have two probability distributions, Px and Qx, the distance between them is defined in this way. Okay, so for every possible outcome, you see what is the difference in absolute value and you sum. It's a very natural metric distance, and we call this a trace distance. For classical probability distributions. This is actually a metric, so one can check things like it's a symmetric, so the distance between Px and Qx is obviously equal to the distance between Qx and Px, and it obeys the triangular inequality, so you can show that the distance between Px and Q Qz. What did I use? I use always P. I always use P here. Okay. Px and Pz is smaller than the distance between Px and Py plus the distance between Py and Pz. Okay. Okay. So let's keep this in mind. Another important feature of this trace distance is that let's consider what we call an event S. An event S is just some subset of all the possible outcomes X's in my probability space. Say, for instance, is if if my probability sample is all the possible outcomes when I roll a certain number of dice, S would be the space of all the outcomes in which the sum of this number is a certain number, 10. Okay? So, of course, the probability of S is just the probability of getting one of the configurations that gives us 10. Now, the interesting thing is this, is that this distance is equal to the max over all the possible subsets that in which I distinguish the probability of S according to P from the probability of S according to Q. So one can prove that, but the intuition is quite obvious. Okay, and again, let's keep this in mind. So this trace distance is useful, but there is another distance that will play an important role for the following, which is called fidelity. The fidelity between probability distributions is the sum of this. Okay? This quantity is interesting, but it's not a metric. It's not symmetric, it doesn't have all the nice properties. However, it does have some very interesting operational meaning that I want to show now, and this is the following. So imagine that I have two coins with different probability distributions, P of heads and 1 minus P of tails, and another coin, Q, 1 minus Q. And I have n trials. And I consider the distribution of the number of heads after n trials. And say that according to P, they get distributed, the heads, in this way. And then according to Q, they get distributed in this way. Would you say that these two probability distributions are distinguishable with a certainty? So imagine you make these measurements, right? These are the outcomes of measurements. You are in the lab. Okay, I measure all the outcomes of my experiments. Okay, so this is my expectation value. And then I measure again this quantity. Another group measures this quantity and finds this other value. And then do they have to argue? Or these two measurements are compatible within the errors? What do you say?
Different.
Huh?
They look different.
This is really a theoretical class, isn't it? So, but you know that when you cannot just claim that this is your measurement. Your measurement is this value plus minus this.
Oh.
Hmm? And this other group is measuring the same quantity. Say, oh, my measurement is this measurement plus minus this. And these two measurements, these two estimates, are compatible within experimental errors. So this is not enough to say, okay, you know, we have measured two different coins. You say that, okay, my situation, I can really distinguish these two outcomes if they do something like this, which happens if P plus Q is smaller than delta P plus delta Q. Yep.
Can you still distinguish the first one if you just like keep making enough measurements that you can get within any arbitrary threshold?
If you, so you know that if you make more measurements, somehow the standard deviation goes down as square root of n. Okay, but now this is what we got, right? We, after n trials, we get this. Okay, so at this, we, this means, oh, we need more measurements to make these things more narrow. And then we will, they will become more narrow, and then you can distinguish them. So, but given your standard deviation, then as long as this is not true, you cannot distinguish them. So now imagine that actually P is very similar to Q, so that it's very difficult to distinguish them. Then this just becomes this, right? Because also the variances will be very similar. Okay. And now I could do this. Imagine that I have this probability distribution and this probability distribution. And I want to say, what is the distance between them? Well, I will say it is 1, 2, 3. So this quantum here, 2 delta p, is like the ticks on a meter stick, right? It's the number of distinguishable probability distributions that there are in between two probability distributions. And now imagine that I make my meter stick very fine resolution so that I have a continuous number of probability distributions in between, then I can define my distance between P and Q like, again, the number of probability distributions that are intermediate between P and Q, which reads one over this, right? Which is the number of intermediate probability distributions. So this is two, and now I have delta P. And what is the variance for a coin? Is square root of P times one minus P over N. So here I would have, and then I have square root of n. And in order to have something that is properly well normalized, I have to divide the number of intermediate probability distribution by square root of n. So I get rid of this. So this is my definition of the distance. And if you do the integral, this is the arccosine of pq plus 1 minus p times 1 minus q. So this is the statistical distance between two coins. OK. Here we only have two outcomes, either have head probability p or tails probability 1 minus p. This formula generalizes, obviously, in the case of any number of outcomes as the arccosine of the sum over all the possible outcomes of px, qx. OK. But now notice, what is this object? Is the fidelity. So this is the arccosine of our fidelity. OK. So this is all we need to know to understand distances, statistical distances, between classical probability distributions. Okay, so now let's go to quantum states, because we said, oh, quantum states. Oh my God. Quantum states are probability distributions. Yes?
Can I just check, when you do that integral inside the R clause, should we have a sum of square roots rather than the square root of a sum?
No, it's the square root of the sum.
Then isn't our definition of fidelity the sum of the square roots?
Oh. Okay, so one of the two is wrong. And I think this one is wrong. Yep. Thanks. Okay. So let's go to quantum states now. So we said quantum states are probability distributions. And let's remember how, in what sense they're probability distributions. So what I have a state, psi. What notation did I use? Let me call it psi 1, because later I will get another. So psi 1 is like the probability distribution P. And then I have another quantum state, psi 2, that somehow should give me the second probability distribution Q. Okay. So in what sense psi 1 is a probability distribution? How does a probability distribution come from a state? What you do is that you do measurements, right? So you measure an observable. An observable A is an admission operator. I can write it in its spectral resolutions. Resolution, it has some eigenvalues and some eigenstates. And you see in these eigenstates, I have the superscript A because they are the eigenstates of A. Okay? And now you say, oh, the probability when I measure A of getting the outcome AI, which from now on I just call PI, is what? Is the overlap squared between the corresponding eigenstate and the state. So this is how in quantum mechanics, from a state, you get a probability distribution. Now you see, though, that this probability distribution depends on what you looked at. Is the probability distribution obtained when I look at A? Because it's given explicitly by this overlap. Now imagine I measure another observable, B. And now I have the eigenstates of B. So I should put B here. Now, let's say that we're lucky, and this B is an operator that commutes with A. What does it mean? That I can diagonalize it in the same basis, A. So if now I try to look at what is the probability distribution obtained when I compute the probability of a BI, so PIB, well, it's exactly the same, right? Because its eigenstates are the same than those of A. It's the same formula. So if the whole world was only made of measurements that are compatible, a quantum state would give us a unique probability distribution, which is the same thing of saying that the world is classical. We can still write operators, states, all you want, but the world is classical. Given a state, there is a unique probability distribution that determines the outcomes of all the possible measurements. and it's one probability distribution. However, the world is non-classical, means that for every A, there are always some other measurements B that do not commute, which means that these are different. So you have different incompatible probability distributions, an infinite number of them, from the same quantum state. So what happens now when I have two states and I want to compare the probability distributions? Let's say I measure A. I measure A for both of them. Then I would have the probability distribution of the state one when I measure A. And the probability distribution coming from the state two when they measure A. And between these, I can have this distance. It's the same that I defined here. Cosine minus one of the fidelity. However, this distance depends on the fact that I measured A. Right? If I measure B, then I have another distance. So what is the distance between quantum states? Well, I measure all the possible objects, and I take the max. So I take the most discriminating of all the possible measurements that I can do, which is reminiscent of what we did here. This is the most discriminating of all the possible measurements that we can do. So imagine you have a bunch of dice, okay? And you have a bunch of fair dice, and then a bunch of dice in which the probability of a six is slightly larger. And I want to distinguish these two probability distributions of the outcomes that I have. So I could try to see that they are different if I measure the probability of getting four equal numbers. But of course, what is the measurement that is most telling of all? The number of sixes that I get. So this is like, you know, looking for the right object. Usually, maximizations over a space of operators, which is exponentially large, is a very daunting task. It's very hard to do that, but not in this case. In this case, it's very easy to exhibit what is the best possible measurement, and it's this one. Is the A max is this one, is some number, some eigenvalue, any, the projector onto psi 1, plus any other orthogonal terms. So all of these objects represent the maximum of this. Why? Let's see. Because what is the overlap? What is this distance? You see? The distance is the cosine to the minus one of the fidelity. And the fidelity is the sum over I of the square root was inside the sum, so sorry about that. Everywhere the square root was inside the sum. Okay. So I have, this is the first probability distribution, phi A psi 1. And the second one will be equal phi ai psi 2. Right? So this is my square root of p, and this is my square root of q. Very good. And now you see that because this is the projector onto psi 1, here I maximize this overlap. So this becomes the cosine to the minus 1 of the sum over I. Well, now every other term will be orthogonal to the others, so we will have here just this one. Psi 1, psi 2. It's the overlap between the states. So that's why the overlap between the states tells us how distinguishable they are. If the two states are very close, so they have a very large overlap, then this is similar to 1, and I can develop this, and this becomes 2, 1 minus f. And this distance is called Fubini-Studim metric. And now this one is a metric. It has all the properties of a metric. OK. So we reached our goal. If we want a distance between states in the Hilbert space, this is the quantity that we must look at, the Fubini-Studim metric. Now our goal is the following. Oops. So first I want to say something else. Okay, I want to give you a piece of math that will be useful in the following. Yeah, so let me do that. So now we want to relate this metric, the Fubini-Studim metric, to other metrics that are possible in Hilbert spaces. And because what other metrics we can have on Hilbert spaces? We can have those metrics that depend on the norm. Okay, so let's do that. So if we have an operator M in a Hilbert space or just in a vector space, you can define the P norm, sometimes called the Schatten P norm, as the trace of M dagger M, P over 2, and then the P root of it. This object here, so the trace of, the square root of M dagger M is called the modulus of M. So this is also equal to the trace of the modulus to the power p, and then we take the p root. Some examples for p equal 1, we have that the 1 norm will just be equal to the trace of the modulus. Obviously, for p equal 2, M2 will just be equal to the square root of the trace of M dagger M. If M is Hermitian, this is the square root of the trace of M squared, because M dagger is equal to M. Okay. So these norms, of course, define a distance on the space of states. So for instance, let us look at this distance, rho minus sigma. So these are two quantum states. They can be mixed or pure, doesn't matter. And I can define a distance in this way. I put a 1/2. Of course, this is equal to 1/2 the trace of the modulus of this difference of these two matrices. And theorem, the details are in the lecture notes. This is equal to this quantity that has a very important operational meaning. So imagine that I have a measurement, P, and I measure P on the state rho. And then I measure P, the same thing, on the state S. And I take the absolute value. Okay. This is a bit like the trace distance, right? I'm making a measurement on two objects, on two states, the same measurement. I see if I get different expectation values. And then I take the max over all the possible measurements. So this is what is called the trace distance for quantum states, because it's the equivalent of our definition that was there. Well, and theorem, it turns out to be equal to the distance induced by the one norm. So this will be very useful in the future, especially when we will start studying quantum correlations like entanglement. We will need to use all this machinery. Okay, so what is our goal now? Our goal is the following. So this is what we will see tomorrow. Because now let's go back to our main topic. We have local Hamiltonians of a quantum many-body system, and we want to say how much states differ from each other when I change my parameters in the parameter space. So what do? I have my parameters lambda, lambda 1, lambda n. Okay. So they live on a manifold of parameters. So for every of these lambdas, I have a Hamiltonian, H depending on lambda. Lambda is like G, or G and H in the quantum XY model. Then for every choice of lambda, I choose the ground state. I diagonalize Hamiltonian, and I find the ground state. So to every point lambda, I can assign a state in the Hilbert space. So a point here will be a state in the Hilbert space. And now it makes sense to say, if I move in this parameter space, so if I have a curve in these coordinates, lambda 1, lambda n, what is the distance between this state and this state? And I will apply this definition. I will use the Fubini's 2D metric. And we will find two things tomorrow. That one, the Fubini's 2D metric on a smooth manifold of parameters becomes a Riemannian tensor, like in general relativity. Okay, so you see a beautiful connection with another completely different part of theoretical physics. Second, this Riemannian tensor sometimes, and you, so you can define the curvature, the rich scalar, everything, sometimes has a spike. This means that this distance that usually, you know, increases continuously, at some point, something dramatic happens to the state. This distance explodes, which means that this state is very different from this one. There you go, you have your equivalence classes. An equivalence class of quantum states means within this class, the metric distance in the differential geometry point of view is well behaved. And now I didn't have to resort to symmetry. So this means if now I want to explore phases beyond symmetry breaking, now I can use this tool. Okay, so we'll see it tomorrow.